Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus and streaming live at kuci.org. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett. This show is recorded on October 22nd, 2020. You can find past shows on iTunes, Stitcher, Amazon, and at the archive writersonwriting.blogspot.com. My guest today is Amor Towles. Born and raised in the Boston area, Amor Towles graduated from Yale and received an MA in English from Stanford. His first novel, Rules of Civility, published in 2011, was a New York Times bestseller and named by the Wall Street Journal as one of the best books of 2011. Amor Towles' second novel, A Gentleman in Moscow, published in 2016, was on the New York Times bestseller list for more than a year in hardcover and was named one of the best books of 2016 by the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the San Francisco Chronicle, and NPR. In the summer of 2017, the novel was optioned to be made into a 16-hour miniseries starring Kenneth Branagh. He's also published short stories, including Even Hollywood, a volume of six interlinked short stories, which follows Evelyn Ross, the character from Rules of Civility, to Hollywood in 1938, and You Have Arrived at Your Destination, a futuristic story published in 2019 as part of the Forward collection by Amazon. Welcome to the show, Amor.
Thanks for having me, Barbara. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. There's so much to talk about, actually, regarding your works. But I wonder if we could begin with how you transitioned from being an investment professional to a novelist.
It wasn't really a transition per se, in that I began writing fiction as a kid. So I began writing fiction in elementary school. I wrote fiction in high school. I wrote fiction in college and then in graduate school. And then it's true that when I arrived in New York as a young man at the age of 25, I joined a friend of mine who had an investment firm, and we ended up working together for 21 years. And the firm continues to thrive. But for me, I've been writing fiction my whole life. There was a period in the middle there, about 10 years, where I stopped writing when our focus was really on building the firm in the early years. But then I began writing fiction again on the side, and Rules of Civility I wrote while employed, as it were. And when that book came out and became a bestseller, I retired from the firm and I wrote Gentleman Moscow as a full-time author.
Interesting. Had you written short fiction or published short fiction prior to Rules of Civility?
I wrote a series of short stories when I was at Stanford in the late 80s, and those appeared in a Paris Review, an edition of the Paris Review in 1989. And that was the last time I was published until Rules of Civility came out in 2011. But that was also the last time I had submitted something for publication, basically, between those time frames.
Interesting. So do you remember what inspired Rules of Civility? It was the first book of yours, the first anything of yours that I read and loved. What inspired it?
Yeah, I think for readers of that book, their guess of what inspired it would generally be right, in that for those who have not read that novel, it describes a year in the life of a 25-year-old woman from a working-class background as she begins to climb the social and professional ladders in New York City in 1938. The whole book it takes place in exactly 1 year. It begins on New Year's Eve and ends on New Year's Eve a year later. But the story is framed around a series of photographs that the American photographer, the great American photographer Walker Evans took in the late 30s on the New York City subways. He would ride the subways with a camera hidden in his jacket and would take a portrait of the person or the people sitting opposite him without their knowledge. And he took hundreds of these. And he ultimately decided that he had invaded the privacy of his subjects, so he wouldn't share them. And 30 years later, roughly, the Museum of Modern Art approached him and said, you know, surely, Mr. Evans, enough time has gone by that you'd be willing to share those photographs with the public. So there was an opening of those photographs in 1966 at MoMA. And I was going through a published collection of those photographs. As a young man, I was in my 20s at the time, and I thought to myself as I went through the photographs, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if someone who was at that opening in 1966 recognized a friend from the late 30s, you know, from the end of the Depression. And as I kept going through the photographs, I thought, oh, even better. What if that person at the opening recognized an old friend in two of the photographs, but that friend had undergone such a transformation between the first and the second photograph that she was the only one at the opening who would recognize that that was the same person in the two pictures. And that's what I wrote down on a little piece of paper as an idea for a story. And that was probably when I was around 25, and 20 or you know, more than a decade later, I sat down to write that novel. And that's the book that became Rules of Civility.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I love those Walker Evans photos. I remember studying them when I was studying photography and love those. It's so interesting though that you wrote on a little piece of paper and kept that little piece of paper.
Yeah, well, and that kind of goes back to I think for those of us who became interested in writing fiction as young people, it became second nature ultimately to constantly be thinking about what would be an interesting story to tell, and then to have at least enough discipline to sketch that down on a matchbook or the back of an envelope. And then you have that kind of next layer of discipline, which is to make sure you don't throw that out. And occasionally that even more admirable level of discipline that you open up a notebook and start to sketch out some of the details of that idea. And so over the course of my life, I've done all of those things. I've got a lot of matchbooks with ideas on them, but along the way I began keeping notebooks where if a particular idea caught my imagination, I might dwell on it. I might dwell on it, steadily over a period of weeks, or I might return to it again and again over a period of years, and adding to those notes that I was writing to myself as I imagined the story more fully. And that's really become a fundamental part of my personal process, which is that in the case of Rules of Civility or the case of A Gentleman in Moscow, the idea for both of those books was I had years before I sat down to write the novel. But then in addition, I, in a focused fashion, spent more than a year outlining both of those books, you know, taking what sketches I had done in notebooks around that story and bringing it to greater clarity, but really as an outline, so that when I sat down to write chapter one, I really have a very strong command of the overall story and its chapters, its characters, its locations, its themes. You know, that's kind of all been thought through by the time I'm tackling chapter one.
Say a little bit more about the outline. Say the outline for Rules of Civility. Did you go as far as to, outline or detail your major characters in terms of, you know, as much as you possibly could know about them at that point and settings and all of that? Or what does that look like?
Yeah, and the way it starts, and this was true in the case of both The Gentleman in Moscow and Rules of Civility, when I decided, this is an interesting idea, I'd like to sort of flesh it out a little bit more detail, taking that sort of one sentence premise and then beginning to think of it as a bigger story. In both cases, in the first 72 hours of thinking about the story, I had written out most of the key events of the book, all the key characters, the key events that occur to them or between them, the surprises or the setbacks or that sort of thing, some of the tones, some of the personality traits of the individual characters, some of their background. Kind of in the first 72 hours in both cases, I had 10 pages of rapid fire notes where the most essential aspects of the novels were sketched out already. That's when I begin to start to dwell. And then, as I say, I might spend a year taking that scaffolding and beginning to break it down in a more formal outline where I'm really asking myself, if these are the various events, what's actually the sequence of chapters here? How many chapters and when do the various characters appear and what do we learn about them when and what are their interactions? And so as I'm over time, over more than a year, filling out taking that scaffolding, turning it into outline and filling out the outline chapter by chapter, all the things that you listed are being pretty fully realized. The characters' backgrounds, the settings, some of the dialogue, certainly the particular, the key elements of what's happening in that particular chapter. So that by the time I'm sitting down to write chapter one, I have probably around a 40-page document that is in essence, and it is an outline. I mean, so literally we'll say chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, and under that, we'll have a great deal of detail about what's gonna happen in that chapter and what I need to know about the places and the people and some of the emotional states and aspirations of the characters that influence that particular chapter. So yeah, I tend to invest a lot of time in that process. People may wonder, you know, why bother? I guess, you know, there are certainly there's certain very fine writers who whose process is really more of who like to discover more in the course of writing. They may not know anything beyond the end of the first chapter, what's happening to their characters. I mean, many writers claim that. I don't know whether it's true, I certainly am not that kind of a writer. There's a great deal of discovery that goes on in the writing process, but I want to come to the beginning of a novel with a lot of knowledge about the work I'm gonna do. And that's partly because of what I'm trying to achieve in a book. Different writers are trying to achieve different things. You're trying to achieve different things than I am, and et cetera. But for me, at least so far, I do like my novels to have a somewhat symphonic quality. What I mean by that is that I want them like a finely composed symphony of Beethoven's or Mozart's, to have, you know, passages in which it goes through movements where motifs are introduced and then recur over the course of the work, potentially played at the same motif at different tempos by different instruments. I want to have modulations and sort of the emotional power of the book, sort of crescendos and diminuendos as the story goes on. And ultimately, I want that feeling that you get in the final minutes of an extraordinary symphony, where you kind of have the last movements and the final notes, and there's that great feeling of like, ah, yes, that is the end of that symphony, and it shouldn't have been a note longer or a note shorter. You know, thank you, Beethoven. And I want my books in a way to deliver that sort of feeling, that when you get to the last sentence, it feels like, yes, that is a complete work of art, and didn't go on a page longer than it should have, and it's nor is it a page short. And I may not always achieve that, but that's the goal. And to get towards that goal, I find that outlining is a critical advantage. It's very hard to sort of achieve that final third of the book really coming together in this way that satisfies all the early aspects of the beginning of the novel, if it has not been thought through with care.
Mm. And speaking of music, music plays such a role in each novel. Do you listen to music when you're writing?
I do. I don't listen to it all the time. I will kind of go, it might be like half the time I'm listening to music while I'm writing, but I do listen to music, and I can listen to music both with and without words. But I will try to pick my music quite carefully. So I'm almost putting on music at the beginning of the morning that somehow is consistent with the work that's ahead of me, you know, and I don't mean that in a period sense. So it's not like I'm listening to 1930s jazz when I was writing Rules of Civility. I did some of that, but that's not really what I mean. It may mean that I'm listening to something from, you know, the 1990s, but where the album kind of has a sort of draws me to a particular state or emotional place that suits the work I want to do that day, you know? So it can be weird things, you know? Right now I've been listening a lot to a relatively new record, by the Bonnie Light Horseman. And I will probably end up listening to that, record 100 times by the time I'm finished my new novel.
Because it somehow has to do with the nope. setting or the time, no?
Just because it puts me in the right mood somehow at the beginning of the day.
in terms of the outline, what about research? Because obviously you were not alive in the 20s or the 30s where rules and gentlemen take place. How much will you do before you start writing, or is research sort of an ongoing thing that happens as you write, as you were writing those books?
It's neither of those two examples. It's kind of a third variation, which is that I don't pick a topic, research it, and write a book. I don't do that. What I do is instead is I pick a topic that already draws on something that I've been deeply fascinated in for a long time. So in choosing to write the Walker Evans story, The Rules of Civility, set in 1938, once I had that idea, part of the reason that idea was compelling to me is because I had been a fan of the 20s and 30s ever since I was a kid. I had seen the movies, I'd read the novels, I'd studied the art movements, I'd listened to the music. So it was very natural for me to sort of to say, yeah, I want to write a book about the late 30s. That would be fun for me, you know, because I would draw on that that depth of fandom that I had been pursuing for decades. And so when I sat down to write Rules of Civility, I write that book from beginning to end without doing any research. At the end, when I'm done with the first draft, I might do some applied research at that point, where I'm going to try to doing some fact checking, doing some sharpening, some details, sort of dwelling in the period in some way that might be additive to the draft that I have in place. And it was the same thing with Gentleman Moscow. Gentleman Moscow takes place between 1922 and 1954. But more importantly, of course, it takes place in Russia. And I don't speak Russian. I don't have Russian heritage. I didn't study Russian literature or history in college or graduate school. But as a late teenager, I became a fan of the Russian novel. And I, you know, read Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. I read them closely, as well as Chekhov and Turgenev and the whole crew. And that led me to an interest in the Russian avant-garde before the First World War and the Revolution. And then that kind of led me into interest into the Soviet era. So over 20 years, let's say, I had taken in a lot of information as a fan about Russian life. And once again, I went setting out to write A Gentleman in Moscow. I did not do any research. I used that longstanding sort of immersion in the topic as the foundation for the work. I invented the first draft, and then I did some applied research after that. Probably most importantly, the whole novel, for those of you who haven't read it, takes place inside the Metropole Hotel in Moscow, because it's about an aristocrat in 1922 who's sentenced to house arrest in the hotel. And so almost all the novel takes place in that building over the course of 30 years. And I decided when I set out to write the book that I would go live in that hotel for a week or so, but I would only do that once the first draft was complete. So that's just what I did. I wrote the first draft, and then I flew to Moscow with, you know, my draft in hand and began the revision process while I was in the hotel and while I was in the city of Moscow, and could draw on that more immediate position to sharpen details or revise the book to its advantage. And, you know, again, why do I postpone the research? And it's different writers have different processes, but for me, I can concern that if I do applied research before I really have a chance to write the book, it'll interfere with my imaginative process. It'll interfere with the freedom with which I want to envision the story, the characters, the circumstances, and it may weigh them down. And you know, I think we've all, to some degree, may have run across a book that feels like that, where you're reading through it as a novel, and it feels like it's weighed down by historical detail or factual detail, scientific detail, whatever body of research the author has been digging through and sort of feeding into the narrative, that it can really get in the way of the most important aspects of the novel, which are the sort of the sparks that bring it to life. So as I say, I'm very wary about applied research, and I tend to defer it until most of the work is already done.
Interesting. Did you find when you were in Moscow that you pretty much got it right? Or did you find that there were details that you were just happy to have gone there to get that particular detail right?
It is a mix. You know, on the, there are many details which are not historically accurate or factually accurate, and I couldn't care less. I mean, you know, and so that's, there are versions of that. Probably most, you know, flagrantly in the case of Gentleman Moscow, in the first couple of pages, the Count is sent to live in an attic room on the sixth floor of the hotel, sort of an old servant's quarters, as a humbling experience by the party. You know, they tell him that he has to give up his suite and go live in this attic room. And there is no sixth floor to the Metropole Hotel. It's a five-story building. And I love that much of the novel takes place in a, you know, in a group of rooms that are kind of imagined on top of the historical hotel. So you have that kind of thing. You know, I'm not going to, and I knew that, you know, going into the story, I knew that it was a five-story hotel, but I don't mind that's clashing with history in that sense, or clashing with reality, or enhancing reality, if I want to put it that way. But certainly there are things that I'll say, oh, you know, this might be on the correction end, you know, oh, right, the KGB was changed its name from the Cheka to the KGB to the, you know, whatever, to the NKVD, to the KVD, to the KGB, you know, in particular years. And you do want to go hunt that down and make sure that, you know, when you're talking about that exact same secret police force, that you're using the right initials at the right time, you know, so you do some of that kind of work. But I think more in the spirit of your question, one of the interesting things for me about that project was that, or that novel, is that the Metropole was really one of the only fine hotels in Russia during the entire Soviet era, from 1920 to 1960. And so almost anybody of significance who visited Russia, or, you know, Moscow in particular, from abroad, either drank at, ate at, or slept at the Metropole Hotel. And what that means is that I could go and hunt down firsthand accounts of events in the hotel, or impressions of the hotel. So John Steinbeck stayed at the Metropole and writes about it quite extensively in his journal about his journey to Russia. The American playwright, Lillian Hellman, who wrote, you know, Little Foxes, writes about her experiences at the Metropole Hotel. E.E. Cummings, the American poet, does. All of the great American and British journalists who visited Russia write about the hotel from 1920 to 1960, because that's where the watering hole was. That's where the bar was, where the British and American journalists hung out. So in each one of their memoirs, whatever the decade, they talk about the hotel. So when I was finishing the first draft, I went out and hunted these down. I Xeroxed these accounts and I carried with them with me to Russia, so that when I was in the hotel, I began to read through them. And, you know, a lot of fun things came out of that process, where, you know, Lillian Hellman may have made an observation about her time in the hotel. And I thought, oh, yeah, this would be a nice way to sort of bring this particular chapter into better focus, or more to life, sort of steal or borrow this observation of Lillian Hellman's and expand on it in the course of chapter X. Harrison Salisbury, the great New York Times journalist, who was the bureau chief in Moscow in the aftermath of the Second World War, wrote an entire memoir about his time in Moscow. The Metropole occurs throughout it, and there are a bunch of terrific things that he witnessed and that I kind of wove back into the novel and add to it. So not so much a correction as getting the opportunity to weave in a part of a firsthand experience to bring a little sort of a flash of light into the narrative as it already existed. I know I'm going on too long about this, but I'll just give you the example of that so you can get a feel for it. When Stalin died, they closed down the city of Moscow, the powers that be. There was concern that there might be a coup, and the various Politburo members and secret police members were sort of jockeying for position in the vacuum. And so they didn't tell anybody he died. They closed the city. And people began to suspect that something was happening. All the American journalists in the Metropole Hotel were not allowed to leave the building. And what Harrison Salisbury remembers is that, or tells us in his memoir, is that suddenly a bunch of the journalists go up to the Mexican attaché's suite which looks out on Theater Square and across Theater Square at this very famous sort of building called the Hall of Unions. And they see a motorcade arriving. All the members of the Politburo are showing up in limousines. And they realize that they've been brought in to see the body. And they realize that not only is Stalin dead, that his body's across the street and you know, it doesn't, the coup has been fended off by bringing the whole Politburo kind of to witness the dead body as a team. And so he tells that story, and that's not central to my novel in any way, but when Stalin dies, I borrow, or I actually have even Salisbury himself kind of describing this, the cavalcade or the motorcade arriving to signal the end of this, you know, era.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I love all those details. I wanted to ask you about the Count and how you landed on him as your protagonist for A Gentleman in Moscow, because at the end of The Rules of Civility, well, throughout, you have young George Washington's rules, you know, kind of coming through the book. At the end, in the appendix, you have all of them listed. And then A Gentleman in Moscow comes. And it seemed to me that it was such a natural evolution for A Gentleman in Moscow and this character to come after Rules of Civility, because he is such a gentleman.
Yes. Well, thank you. And I should say, first of all, that my new novel, which will come out next fall, is about three 18-year-old boys in the 50s on their way from Nebraska to New York City. And there is nothing civil or gentlemanly about them, basically. So I don't want to suggest that all of my books will to some degree sweep these ideas in. But it is true that in very different ways, I think, the notions of what it means to be a gentleman or you know, gentlemanly behavior play a role in clearly in Rules of Civility and John Moscow. And as I say, in very different ways. In the case of Rules of Civility, it's very much in sort of the tradition of, you know, to some degree a WASP tradition, but the sort of the New York aristocracy and how they behaved and what they looked like and whether it was a facade or whether it was genuine and the degree to which the appearance of sort of an honorable person could either be reflection of their integrity or could mask a lack of integrity. You know, that's the nature of a refined posture, refined behaviors, that it can either reveal or mask. And as someone is navigating, you know, the social life of New York in the 30s, you're constantly sort of bumping into the edges of that paradox. And you know, so that's that. In the case of Gentleman in Moscow, it's a little bit almost a more almost a bigger canvas, because the Count was born in 1890, so he is kind of a child of the 19th century as an aristocrat in the European style. From the 19th century, you know, the aristocrats across Europe had far more in common with each other than they had with their own countrymen in terms of, you know, how they were educated, their taste in cuisine, their fashion, their principles that they lived by, their sense of what was right and wrong, the way they behaved towards each other. These were all sort of codified and shared across the aristocracy in the upper classes in 19th and 18th century Europe. And that's what the Count is raised out of, right? He's coming out of that. And he's suddenly under house arrest at the beginning of the Soviet era, when almost every aspect of the life that he knew and of the values that he would have prioritized are being, if not uprooted, then radically ordered by the new generation. You know, which not only is not aristocratic for the most part, really sees aristocratic trappings and behavior as the enemy of progress. And so, so you have what is, there is much to be said to, obviously, to the discredit of the Soviets in terms of the trials that the Russian people went through. To their credit, and there are things that are to their credit, but to their credit are, they modernized the country. you know, Russia was the most backward of all of the Western European great nations when the First World War began. It was 95% of the population was illiterate. More than 80% of the population were peasants who were working on other people's land. And so, and there was no industry in the country, whereas America and England and Austria had really substantial industry at that point. And one of the things that the Bolsheviks did when they took over is they launched a rapid modernization effort. They required literacy of all citizens within a series of years, and they funded that. So they actually achieved like 95% literacy from 5% literacy in less than a decade. They did industrialize the country rapidly and effectively. There was a great social cost to obviously to these progresses. But so what kind of interests me in terms of the moment of time of the General of Moscow is that the count represents kind of this 19th century, the height of 19th century attitudes and achievements. And he's suddenly being dropped into, as it were, in a very rapidly moving, aggressive modernization of Russia, you know, led by the Bolsheviks. And so you almost have the two centuries, the 20th century, and the 19th century, you know, going from one century to the next with the flick of a switch, and the count has a foot in both. And so his gentlemanly kind of behavior, it's not quite what, so the refined version that we see in Rules of Civility, but it's much more of this bigger landscape of two ways of living at war.
Hmm. Well, in fact, he is such a gentleman that he takes the rap for a friend that gets him arrested.
No, not exactly. Because he's it's kind of the reverse. He's sentenced to house arrest for being an aristocrat. But he's spared execution. So he's not sent to prison. He is not, you know, officially arrested. He is not executed or exiled, you know, all things which could have happened to him as an aristocrat, because he wrote a poem as a young man that was very popular with the revolutionary generation. And so they let him off, as it were, by virtue of his authorship of that poem. Now, later in the novel, you know, I don't want to do any spoiling, but the authorship of that poem ends up being comes into question, and that's a part of the story. But yes, it is in essence the poem that saves his life.
Okay, all right, yeah, I got that wrong, because as I was reading, I was thinking he did not write the poem, but his friend Mishka, he did something for his friend Mishka. So now I'm going to have to go back and take a look at that page and see.
Well, okay, so you can cut all this out if you want. but what you're referring to is what he did for his friend Mishka was something that was back when the poem came out. Because when the poem came out in in the early 20th century, mm-hmm. 1910 or 1914 or something like that, before the war, so maybe 1911 or something. At that point, the poem is really calling on the intelligentsia, the aristocracy, to relaunch the era of reform that they had had in place at the beginning of the 20th century, and that was ultimately quashed, however you say that. So there was a moment of reform. The intelligentsia and the nobility were backing it, and it was then shut down, destroyed, and everybody was silenced. And the count's good friend, who is not as in strong standing as he is from an aristocratic standpoint, writes a poem really calling everybody back to action. This is years before the revolution. And the poem is called "What Is Our Purpose Now?" where he kind of asks these people, what are we doing? Why are we spending our time doing, playing bridge or whatever in a living room? We should be out changing the country. And what they recognize, the two friends, is that if Mishka were to publish that poem under his own name back then, which is say years before the revolution, that he would probably be swept up by the Tsar's police as someone who's politically unreliable. But the count is such stature as an aristocrat, he's got the right family, as it were, that if it were published under his name, that they could not arrest him or send him away. And so, yes, the count, years before the story begins, does this gesture for his friend, and then it ends up saving his life, when the revolution comes.
Okay, good. So I got it partly right. In any case, I loved it. It was such a great book to read during these times. You know, I mean, I've had it for years. I think I was actually invited to the launch party in LA maybe some years ago and couldn't make it. Yeah. And could not make it. I wish I had, but it was wonderful to read it now, you know, during this time we're in. And I want to talk, well, there's one thing I want to talk about before we talk about your story. And then if we have time, come back to this, but that is that you use ellipses quite a lot throughout the book, which made me happy because I like ellipses. And not quite halfway into the novel, the Count comments on ellipses because the bishop uses them at the ends of his questions. And as I was reading that, I wondered if the author, if you felt a need to comment on your own use of ellipses.
You know, I don't mind using any tool. You know, anytime a writer or instructor of writers or instructor of fiction or critic of fiction sort of makes a strong stance around, you know, this is should not be used, that should not be used, you know, I'd always kind of, you know, I find that, you know, it little me, it's like telling painters this is the one color you should never use in the canvas. You know, it's kind of crazy to me. You know, I had a very, you know, well-known critic, a great thinker, very read Rules of Civility and review it, and she loved the book, but she opened by saying, you know, prologues and epilogues have no places in novels, you know, because there's a prologue and epilogue, you know, and that, you know, she wanted to make that point very strong, you know, and even though I love this book, you know, that this is outrageous that there's a prologue and an epilogue, and I you know, I always find those kinds of things sort of kind of crazy, but so yeah. To me, they're all elements of craft, and they have their place in certain stories. They don't have their place in others. There's very few ellipses, if any, in my new book. You know, as these young 18-year-olds are sort of talking in very blunt form towards each other without much nuance and without much hesitation. And, you know, whereas in the conversations that are swirling around the Count, I sort of found them kind of constantly popping up as sort of everybody sort of saying, well, you know, you look great today, dot, 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 you know, and there's all kinds of opportunity for, you know, sort of this, that little hesitation that, you know, that comes at the end of a statement or of a question that suggests that there's something more that was intended, you know, and so, yes, the, you know, they're kind of played throughout, but then the Count, you know, it drives him crazy that, you know, this one character in particular is using them as kind of this, in this overbearing way. And, but so yeah, to me, it is an element of craft. You know, as a warning to those of you who care about these things, there are no quotation marks in Rules of Civility. All dialogue is with the M dash, you know, and yes, there's quotation marks in Gentleman Moscow. And I, you know, why is there one in one and not in the other? And why is there M dashes and not quotation marks? And all I can tell you is that while I was writing Rules of Civility, the quotation marks were bugging me. They didn't feel like, they felt that they were alien to the story I was trying to tell and bogging it down. Sounds like a crazy remark, but here's what I mean by it is that if you think about the quotation mark, which is a great tool in the English language, but when you think about it, its purpose very often is to allow you to interrupt what somebody's saying, so that the narrator can step in and tell you something else before the comment is finished. You know, so that's what it's there for. So, for instance, you know, the person says, well, you know, then he said to his aunt, well, I'm not sure I'm gonna be able to state, you know, or it'll say, you know, quote, I'm not sure I'm gonna be able to state, you know, for tea, he said, as he looked at the door, you know, and you know, thought about Elaine, you know, because I might have to be somewhere else to two, you know, whatever. Like, and the whole point of that, the quotation marks is so that when you stuff that thing in the middle, that gives you the insight into what the guy is thinking or what's on his mind or whatever else, what he's remembering, she's remembering. It's so that you know that what's the difference between the part that's being spoken and the part that is the narrator telling you some additional piece of information. And as I was writing the book, and I've been writing, as I say, for, you know, at this point for more than 30 years, and I'd always used a quotation mark, it was just driving me crazy in the context of telling the story of Rules of Civility, in that it was sort of this invitation to get in the way of the characters. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to remove the quotation marks, and I'm going to write this in such a way that I'm not going to have those little inserts. You know, you're going to get the dialogue itself, the person going to talk and the other person respond, and then, you know, call response. And you're going to need to know from what they're saying, whether they're saying it sarcastically or hesitating or as they're walking out the door. You know, that, I wanted as much of it to be kind of built into the language of the exchange itself as possible. And so the removal of the quotations ended up making me I had to write in a much more streamlined fashion in the service of these characters. And that was right for that book in my mind. And it kind of had this great sort of Deca look to it too. You know, I visually like the look of it in those characters. Whereas when I was writing Gentleman in Moscow, suddenly it seemed so natural to the Count to have the quotation marks for the reasons I was complaining about a minute ago. He's just the kind of guy who would want to interrupt what he was saying in order to make a couple of observations or a side comment or a parallel or what have you. And so, you know, for him, they're central. So as I say, each one of these little things, whether it's semicolons or exclamation points or splitting the infinitive, you know, which I love to do, they're elements of craft, and they have their place in some works and they don't have their place in others.
Yeah, I do like in Rules of Civility that you use em dashes to indicate the dialogue instead of just putting it there without anything. I mean, sometimes it's hard to keep track of when writers do that. They don't use quotation marks, but they don't do anything else. And yes. Yeah, I love that. Well, you know, we have a few minutes left, and I have to talk about You Have Arrived at Your Destination. I read it twice. I loved it. What inspired the story?
And that's kind of a weird story. I've written short stories, certainly, you know, most of my, you know, since the time I was 12 or 13 or something like that. And I've written many over the course of my life. In the last, between Rules of Civility and Gentleman, I hadn't written many short stories in the last, say, 25 years. And when Rules of Civility came out and I was on the road talking about the book with readers, going to bookstores and what have you, I couldn't start my new novel when I was on the road talking about Rules of Civility. I found that very difficult. I want to be done fully with book A before I'm working on book B, and I want to be at home and, you know, with my full awareness on the task. And so I went back to writing short stories during that sort of period between book, you know, between Rules of Civility and Gentleman in Moscow. I wrote a bunch because I found that while I was on the road or in between, you know, element aspects of the tour, I could take 3 weeks and at least start or make significant progress in a story or even finish one. So I began writing a bunch of short stories, and what ended up happening is that Blake Crouch, very fine writer he's known as a writer of science fiction. That's probably too small a term to describe really what he does. Mm-hmm. His last book, which is a great bestseller, is called Recursion, and it's a combination of science fiction related ideas, but also sort of noirish atmosphere and just fine traditional storytelling as well. And so he's an excellent writer of the current era. And he reached out to me and he said, you know, Blake said, I've been asked to put together a group of short stories, science fiction related short stories by Amazon, who's the one who commissioned this little anthology from scratch. And he said, you know, I went to them they said, well, you can choose anybody you want. He said, well, I've gotten, you know, Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian. I got N.K. Jemisin, a number of really terrific leading writers in sci-fi and fantasy. And he said, but I want to know whether or not you'd be willing to do it, because he was a fan of Gentleman in Moscow. He's like, I want to know how Tolles would treat, a science fiction tale. And so, you know, that was a great invitation, particularly because probably the first author that I read from beginning to end was Ray Bradbury as a, you know, 13-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. And I'm very fond of the genre, as it were, and of its possibilities. I wasn't going to go write something like Andy Weir or N.K. Jemisin's work. So what I ended up doing is I wrote a story that was, I call it set 5 minutes in the future. So, you know, looking just over the horizon to, you know, where technology is taking us, and then really trying to do sort of a character driven moment of, in this case, a young husband. He and his wife are trying to have a child, and they kind of go to speak to, or he goes to speak to the current leading edge in you know, getting help and having a child, which entails not simply getting pregnant, but potentially influencing the type of child you're going to have. And so this kind of became the story. You have arrived at your destination was in response to that. Now, I should say that Viking, my new novel will come out under Viking Penguin, as my last two have. And they have also will be doing a collection of my short stories in a couple of, you know, maybe 2 years from now. And so I went back to that story in particular. And what I found is I don't think it's finished. And so there are various particular aspects of it that I kept coming back to in the aftermath of writing that story. And you will see that story again. It'll be in a short story collection in a few years, and it'll be probably about three times longer. Mm-hmm. And will involve a whole new array of elements. I mean, what it is now will still be there, but it will just keep expanding outward into sort of a little bit larger, more convoluted piece. But yeah, that's kind of the story of you have arrived at your destination.
I'm glad to hear that, because I didn't know that. I didn't think it was finished, but because I love it as it is, but I like that it's going to be extended. You know, I wanted to know what happened next, because it just seemed like it was just beginning. This problem is just beginning for this guy.
That's right. Thank you. Yeah, I felt the same way. And which, which is, by the way, you know, where Even Hollywood came from. The one that you mentioned earlier is that, and I guess that was the first short story project I picked up after Rules of Civility. But when Rules was done, I really had no desire to investigate the lives of Katie or Tinker further, who are really the two most central characters of that story. And I really felt that if I were to write anything more about either one of them, it would be a disservice to Rules of Civility as a novel. That everything that I was supposed to tell you about them is in that book. And anything that I did not tell you is something that you should be imagining yourself at this point, you know. But Eve, this sort of third critical character in that story, who kind of disappears halfway through that novel, you know, heading off to the West Coast, she's the one who I kept coming back to at night being like, oh man, I wonder where she is. What's she up to? She's a real troublemaker, and I thought she was a terrific character. And so that's why I sat down to write the six stories about Eve when she arrives in Hollywood in 1938, having just left Katie and Tinker in New York, and to see kind of where she ends up. And that was a fun process for me to investigate those stories.
So I have to ask you, so you've written about the 20s through the 50s, and like you said, your next novel takes place in the 50s, and now you have arrived at your destination is in the future. So what about the present? I mean, are you going to be writing about the present at all? Along with that, I'm wondering if you feel that writers writing now have a responsibility to make some mention of the pandemic.
Okay. So let me unpack your question, because it's two parts.
Yes.
So the first part is, if I look at like the short stories that are going to be in the collection, a lot of them are kind of set in between, I don't know, I'd say 1985 and 2005, you know, so the a minute ago, you know, as a, so my young adulthood, you know, the a period which is very recognizable to almost any reader in today's environment. So they'll have a very contemporary feel, because you know, really at the end of the day, 2005 and 2020, there are differences, but not dramatic, not earth shattering, I don't think. But so you know, that's kind of creeping a little bit closer to the present. Would I write a story set in my immediate present? I would certainly consider that. And I, you know, I probably will do that at some point. I think that To go to the second part of your question, you know, about COVID or about including it, I am not a person who is very compelled or interested in writing a book which is pointed at my times. You know, I'm very wary about that as an impulse. Now that, you know, in the world of nonfiction, of course, much of the best nonfiction, that's what it is doing. That's its purpose. You know, Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, is wants to look at where are we? Who are we? What are we doing? What should we be doing? And to address that in essays. And that's, like, you know, an incredible thing, you know, or whether the people who are investigating, you know, the changes in our social strata, the technology of the times, the gender issues of the times. So these are absolutely topics that writers of nonfiction should be tackling. Now, there are novelists who are interested in doing that too. And I'm definitely not one of them. And as I say, I'm very wary of that. And I'm much more interested, it's probably my background in terms of as a student of literature and a lover of classic literature, I kind of think of the novel at its greatest as being a machine for meaning, which is that it's an artistic experience that we enter into. And at its best, we're engaged in it, we're entertained by it, we're satisfied by it. But the composition of the components in that work of art are so multifaceted, so many contrary and different components operating in harmony simultaneously, that, you know, we can take 10 people who can read that book, be engaged in it, enjoy it, and walk away with very different impressions of what it means to them. And that, you know, and of course, this is why the great masters of writing books like I just described, why those books survive, you know, why we read Shakespeare today, because that's just what he's done. He has successfully created something which is engaging, entertaining, but has these elements of these components which interact in such a way that different people can draw very strong and valid conclusions and feelings from in interacting with that work. And so that someone, people from different genders can read it, from different races, from different social classes. And the same person could read that text at the age of 20 and 40 and 60 and 80 and enjoy it each of those times and walk away with a different impression of it each time. You know, if you read War and Peace at the age of 20, 40, 60, and 80, it would be a different experience each time, but equally rewarding. And that's because Tolstoy is very successful at creating this machine for meaning. And that's really... that's what I'm gunning for, you know, rightly or wrongly or successfully or in failure. That's what my ambition is for. And so the idea of writing something to the point or to with a particular message or with a particular timeliness, I think is probably undermines or can undermine the pursuit of that ambition, right? We think about War and Peace. War and Peace took place, you know, a generation before Tolstoy's time. Right, you know, he's writing in the 1850s or 60s, and that took place in the, you know, around 1812 or whatever. Mm-hmm. He's looking back, you know, or you know, significantly. George in Middlemarch is looking back a generation. And George Eliot's work, and that's, you know, but so a little bit of looking back can be very productive, I think, for the novelist in terms of achieving this goal. We think about 100 Years of Solitude. You know, that's literally looking back 100 years and working to some kind of a present, which is, you know, barely the present, but in terms of Marquez's work. I am much more interested in that, in writing something which is timeless and trying to, and in the belief that if you can succeed in doing it, the book will find, you know, its readers will find meaning in it, at, you know, decade in and decade out in different ways. And I think that's, you know, the great beauty of the novel as an art form.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of, you mentioned War and Peace, do you have a favorite Russian novel or a favorite novel or novels that you return to that you'll reread?
My three favorite novels, I mean, really are the ones I admire the most. It would be even a better way of putting it, are War and Peace, 100 Years of Solitude, and Moby Dick by Melville. And you know, what those three kind of share, it's in common. It's not a controversial list, right? But what they share in common is, you know, is these are books that are incredibly ambitious in the scope of what they're trying to cover. And they are simultaneously very rich depictions of the lives of individuals in the way that, you know, a Jane Austen novel would be, but at the same time are bringing in, you know, the movement of history and the movement of ideas and, you know, this incredible span, but then brought sort of from beginning, middle, end in these, you know, very cohesive, beautifully contained works, despite, you know, all the crazy things that are going on inside them. And so you know, I really do admire those books, probably above all others.
I wanted to talk about one more element of craft before we go, actually. We've been here a while and not long enough, but I wanted to talk about your similes and metaphors. Because you really do seem to be the master of the simile and metaphor. One of my favorites is on around 220, I think, about oranges. And it's so gorgeous. I wonder if similes and metaphors come naturally to you, or do you have to work for them?
That's a good question. I don't work for them per se, but I might come up with eight different parts of the book and only keep two. You know what I mean? So it's not so much that I'm struggling over what's the right metaphor for this moment. It's more that they're kind of cropping up at different times to play different roles in the storytelling. And some of them I'm like, oh, that's great. And some of them I'm like, that's just is either boring or cliche or it's or redundant or whatever, and get rid of it, you know? And so, you know, you kind of hope through that process that that the ones that survive are you know, are fresh and relevant to the moment in the narrative. You know, but I think of it as, excuse me, I like to think of, you know, Andre Agassi is, you know, one of the great tennis players from my generation and from, you know, when I was coming of age. And the way I like to think of it is Andre Agassi doesn't have a great forehand, right? Andre Agassi has 100 great forehands, right? So he has a forehand which is rushing the net and hitting the ball from the, you know, mid-court, you know, when it's low on the ground, you know, to, you know, hit a shot which is, you know, deep into the court. He's got a forehand where he's reeling backwards and he's hitting a topspin from, you know, 6 feet behind the baseline. You know, he's got a forehand where he's crossing, you know, from one corner of the court to the other, and, you know, and he's going to shoot in the direction the opposite that you think he is, you know, whatever. They're all, each one of them is very different in, and each one of them he has practiced thousands of times, you know, until he has mastered each one of them. And so that when he's in play, he's not like, oh, how do I hit this ball? You know, what he's doing is he knows physically how to hit that ball at that moment in that spot. And that allows him therefore to pay attention to other things, right? Which is the game as a whole, you know, and where he is and where he wants to be next. And it should be second nature to him, you know, how to return this ball in this instant. And I feel like that's what the writing craft is very much like this, right? Is that metaphor is an element of craft. Simile is. Allusion is a metaphor, is an element of craft. Allegory is an element of craft. But as are dialogue and setting and tone of voice and point of view. You know, these are all the poetry of language, you know, the sound of the language. These are all elements of craft. And over the course of time, you through, you know, short story after short story or whatever, you're trying to master those elements of craft. And it's an important point to make that if you take, you know, tone of voice as an example, every story you tell should have a different one, you know, and if you talk about metaphor, every story you tell should use metaphor in a different way that is consistent with that story, right? It's not like metaphor is one thing. Metaphor is 100 things, like beforehand. And so you're trying to master all the different ways that metaphor might be used. And so that when you suddenly find yourself telling the story about a shy, you know, girl in, you know, the Midwest, you know, who's just been asked on a date, that the right type of metaphor for her shows up and speaks to the language. And for some characters, that may mean no metaphor at all, right? And so anyway, that's the kind of the way I think of it, is you're trying to organically use those elements of craft and to bring to fruition the particular story in the particular fashion that suits it well.
That's a great note to end on. I am so sorry we're at the end of our time.
It's all right, Barbara. Thank you.
Such a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much. And maybe you'll come back when your next book comes out.
I would be happy to. And thanks for having me, Barbara.
You're welcome. And thank you, all of you out there listening. Hope you're getting some work done these days. Come back here next Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific time. We'll have more. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing.